episode 1216, The 9 Days of Christmas.
Welcome to the Cookie Christmas. I think we usually say in the title, Cookie Christmas. So should be like episode whatever.
But yeah.
Cookie Christmas. I'll add that in.
Perfect.
Welcome to the Sci-Fi Christian. We're back, listeners. It's the Christmas season. Merry Christmas to you.
Merry Christmas.
And
Christmas
to your family.
Just a few days away.
Yes.
And don't worry, this won't be the only Kooky Christmas episode. We'll go into January.
Yeah, you reminded us last year that the true Christmas season starts on Christmas Day.
I mean, I got a...
We're in the waiting period right now, the Advent season.
At least one more good Oops All Hitler edition of Kooky Christmas to go for. This one's actually going to be a little more serious. I was redoing a little reading on Nazi UFOs, and so we could maybe get into that next time, which will be a little bit goofier. But this one, I think, will actually be an interesting episode for us, because what I want to get into today is the occultic backdrop of Nazism, which is actually a really interesting topic to me. It shows up, of course, in pop culture. You know, you have Raiders of the Lost Ark as probably being the most prominent example.
Of course, Captain America, the first Avenger.
Well, they're not Nazis in that.
Well, Hydra is like the pretend Nazis.
Yeah, I'm not going to count that.
Okay.
The Wolfenstein video games. Like, it's something that shows up, and I think everybody knows that there's at least some historical basis, but I don't think people quite know what to do with it. And certainly, I don't think Nazism is very often treated as an occult phenomenon. It's really treated more as a modernist phenomenon, I was going to say, when people want to be critical of it, but I think everybody wants to be critical of it. As do we.
Ben, yes, of course.
I mean,
I wish that you didn't have to tell people so often how you're against Nazis.
It'll become clear. I'm
you're very anti-Nazi.
Yeah,
I don't
like those guys at all.
I hope the listeners really understand that about you, that although you mention Hitler often,
so
you are anti-Nazi.
What I was trying to say was actually the inverse of what I said, meaning that people will use Nazism to critique modernism at times. For example, it's kind of like, if you want to people tie, like, I've seen, and not without some merit, see some Christian authors tie, like, Darwinism to Nazism and, like, the evolutionary thing, and you get the whole master race and tie that out to Darwinism. And I think that when you look
and you like evolution.
I mean, just my favorites. But I think that when you look at, like, the Nazis and the other great evil of the 20th century, communism, we do tend to look at them through a purely materialistic modernist lens. And I think that in the case of communism, that makes a degree of sense, meaning that communism is sort of this, if we go back to our Ian McGilchrist right brain, left brain framing, it's this left brain attempt to impose a system on mankind from the top down, and a system that at least theoretically can seem like it will work, but then when you put it into practice, it absolutely blows up. And I think we tend to look at Nazism as sort of the same thing. And there are elements of that in there. Of course, we have, you know, the Great Militarization Project, the attempt to rebuild Germany in the post-interwar period. And so you have economic factors going on there. I think that, as I mentioned, with the tie to Darwinism and social Darwinism, people trot out Nazism as a exemplar of the dark side of the Enlightenment, be that eugenics or extreme nationalism or anything like that. So we tend to, and I think historians tend to, look at the Nazis as primarily or exclusively a modernist phenomenon, a materialistic phenomenon, in the same way that the Soviet Union tended to be. And then the occult stuff, we don't know quite what to do with that. And I think, though, that one of the things that differentiates Nazism from communism is that Nazism, the occult piece, wasn't just a byproduct. It wasn't just a nice thing on the side. It was actually an essential part of it. And what we're going to see as we go through this, and we're actually going to set our sights a little bit higher than just the Nazis as we go through this and bring it in even into our modern age, what we're going to see is that those two poles, those two forces that feel like they're opposite, the materialistic modernist thing and the occult that feels archaic and medieval, are not actually in opposition to each other. They're very much intertwined. And they're intertwined not only in Nazi Germany, they're intertwined in very dangerous ways in our own age today. To make this point about like the difference between communism and Nazism, I want to quote one of my big sources for this episode, a book called Unholy Alliance by an author named Peter Lavenda. And he makes this, I have a few quotes from him as we go. But he makes this good quote, or this good point. He says, the majority religions of Western, or sorry, I grabbed the wrong part of that there. He says, whereas communism set itself up as in opposition to all religion, Nazism supported a pagan revival to replace the existing religions. And that's really what it does. When you look at the ostentation of Nazism, you look at even the language of the Fourth Reich, and especially as we're going to dig into a whole concept of Arianism, what we see there is we see a neo-paganism that is cooperating with modernism in favor of something that was far different and far more evil than anything else we've seen in recent history. So what I want to zero into with this, because there's so many different areas you can go to with this. And I think I've teased some of this to you. You can talk about the influence of figures like Aleister Crowley, the great great in terms of significant, not great in terms of a moral judgment, the great British occultist who may or may not have had ties to Nazi Germany. Some argue that he was essentially an agent of the British during World War II. Others that he was co-opted by Nazism. Certainly there was a lot of intellectual overlap with him and some of the Nazi occultic ideas. You can go in that direction. You can go kind of the Raiders of the Lost Ark direction and talk about the Nazi quest for religious artifacts. There's a book that I haven't read, but it apparently is wonderfully kooky, that talks about the Nazi search for the Holy Lance, the lance that pierced the side of Christ. And you certainly have all of that. But the one I wanted to explore a little bit today is this concept of the Aryan race. It's like, that's a term that's thrown out to us in relation to Nazism, but what does it actually mean and what are we talking about? And to maybe set the table for this, I'd ask you to consider the swastika, this symbol of Nazism that we're all familiar with. And if you know anything about the swastika, you'll know that it's not original to Nazism. And in fact, there's one part of the world where you will see swastikas all over the place, especially on temples. Do you know what it is?
Is it a country?
Yeah.
Is it? I don't want to guess wrong. Just tell me.
It's India.
Okay.
Of all places. So the swastika is a very, in slightly different configuration than the Nazis had it. They have the reverse and rotated swastika. But the swastika shows up all throughout India. If you go to Hindu temples and look at Hindu artwork, you'll see swastikas all over the place. And that's, I'm sure, a rather uncomfortable thing for Hindus today to have that association. But the Indian swastika is actually, it's a far older symbol than Nazism. So how did we get here? Well, we get here to explore this. We have to understand a little bit of Icelandic, Nordic lore and mythology that really drove the Nazi project. And that's where we get this concept of a hidden land, a hidden underground land called Thule, Thule. Okay? So let me just read you a description of Thule. This is again from Peter Lavenda. And this is going to sound like we're a million miles away from Nazism, or will it? The ancient homeland of the Aryan race was believed to be the legendary Thule, the northernmost point on Earth, an entryway into a subterranean landscape peopled by giants, You're thinking, okay, yeah, well, this we're in kooky Christmas territory here. We got underground kingdoms. A kind of Teutonic Eden, Thule or Ultima Thule was the mythic origin of all Aryans, an equally mythic white-skinned, blue-eyed, blonde-haired race of wise giants who were once the masters of the earth, but who lost their birthright due to sexual liaisons with the irresistibly seductive members of inferior, subhuman, half-animal races. Okay, so there's a lot to unpack within that statement. Let's just put the Nazi stuff aside here. Like, we have the makings of a pretty familiar mythology to us. Like, this isn't, uncommon, this type of myth in human history. You have the Edenic homeland. Okay, check. We have that sense of things. We have the sense of humanity's best days being in its past. I was thinking of Tennyson's poem of Ulysses that we've talked about, you know, the great line, we are not that now that strength which would have all old moved heaven and earth. So even when we think of like the golden age of heroes of Odysseus, even there, like we tend to put language into their mouths that speaks of the golden age of heroes as being beyond us. You have the sense, especially in the pre-modern world, of lost lands and places that maybe you could go to find them, be it the Atlantis narrative or here. So we have a lot of things that are pretty familiar with us.
It sounded a little bit like the Nephilim.
Right. Like, yeah, giants, all of that. Like, we have pieces of mythology in this bit of lore that are certainly not uncommon to the world. And then we have a few pieces that do kind of stand out and make us go, oh.
Like the animal ladies?
The animal ladies. Let's first start with, of course, the use of the word Aryan. Now, the Aryans, yeah, we're familiar with that language, of course, from the Nazi regime and with their racial science, using that term in loose quotes, but maybe not. We'll come back to that point. And this whole idea of an Aryan race that's underground. And we get the description of them. Blonde-haired, blue-eyed, white-skinned. Well, there's your big three for the Nazis. And what are they upset about? Like, what are they upset about? How did we fall from grace? Well, they fell from grace by mixing with inferior races, ones who are not white-skinned, blonde-haired, blue-eyed. So we have an interesting mix here in this little narrative of pieces that feel like they're way from the archaic past and pieces that feel shockingly right out of Nazi Germany. And what we have in this little snippet, I'm going to argue, and Peter Lavenda is going to argue in his book, was actually a significant mythological driver of the Nazi project. So then the question becomes, how do you get from that little bit of mythology into Nazi Germany? Well, before we answer that question, let's stop to consider something that we talked about in the AI episode. And I'm going to reread the quote that I did there because it's worth renoting. So I mentioned this book, Against the Machine, that I've been, by Peter Kingsnorth. Let me just make sure I'm in the right place.
Yeah, we talked about that just last week during our preview. You're previewing A Nuanced View of AI.
Right.
Next year, we'll follow up early next year with the full Nuanced View of AI episode.
Yeah, and I think that some of this, even here tonight, is going to continue in with setting that up. But let me just reread the quote that I read last night. Or not last night, at the last episode. There is a throne at the heart of every culture, and whoever sits on it will be the force you take your instruction from. The modern experiment has been the act of dethroning both literal human sovereigns and the representatives of the sacred order, and replacing them with purely human and purely abstract notions, the people, or liberty, or democracy, or progress. I'm all for liberty, and it would be nice to give democracy a try one day, too, but the dethroning of the sovereign Christ, who sat at the heart of the Western sacred order, has not led to universal equality and justice. Paris. It is led via a bloody shortcut through Robespierre, Stalin, and Hitler. There's our guy. To the complete triumph of the power of money, which has splintered our culture and our souls into a million angry shards. Let me expand on this thought for the purpose of this episode in a direction that I think Peter Kingsnorth would agree. And this, by the way, this book, Against the Machine, maybe the book of the year for me. Yeah, I'm almost done with it. I'm going to finish it this week. Profound. Very, very profound. So I highly, highly recommend it. This concept of the dethroning of Christ in Western civilization, he, much to my delight, would trace the origins to two things. One, of course, being the Enlightenment, and the other, the Reformation. Now, I don't think that necessarily is an argument against Protestantism, but it is an argument to say, or at least an observation to say, that the Reformation shook the theological foundations of Western Christianity in a major way. I think that's pretty much unarguable. Whether or not that shaking was a good thing or not is something we can disagree about, but certainly it helped. That shaking helped pave the way, I think, for the 1-2 punch of the Renaissance, followed by the Enlightenment that would come later, which would very deliberately seek to do with the Reformation in the spirit of all fairness, absolutely did not, which is to dethrone, demythologize Christ, dethrone Christ at the heart of Western civilization. Well, here's the thing about dethroning figures like Christ. I say like that because I want to broaden it out beyond just Western culture. When you dethrone the heart of value in a culture, the throne doesn't stay empty. Other forces begin vying for it. And part of what's fascinating in Kingsnorth's argument is that he's going to argue throughout this book about different things that have tried to vie for it. And one of them, of course, is the Enlightenment values of modernism, of rationalism, left brain thinking, all of that. You know, he hasn't quoted Ian McGilchrist yet, but I'm positive he's read him because he has come so close to that type of language. But then the other one is this sense of paganism that exists in our culture. I have a quote I'll read from Kingsnorth a little bit later on in this that's going to get into this in great detail, but let me just tease it with this shorter one here. Kingsnorth's background is he was an environmentalist for a long time, made a pit stop as a Wiccan, so an occultist, and more recently in the last several years, and I don't know the details of this, but through a series of supernatural visions, became an Eastern Orthodox Christian. So he's had a wild journey. So he has a chapter in here, and we're going to quote from it a little bit later. But just to set the table for this, he talks about the relationship between magic and science. He says, we see daily the path that magic and science will take us down. Do what thou wilt, which is actually a quote from Aleister Crowley. Aleister Crowley, when he set up his own occult cult, if you can call it that, he said, do what thou wilt shall be the whole of the law. Is the motto of our world. Do what thou wilt is the motto of our world, the motto of the machine. Thy will be done is its older brother and its challenger. So Kingsnorth's argument, and again, we'll get into some more details of this, is that, yes, we primarily have this modern rationalism, but you also have this occult undercurrent that has also vied for the throne that Christ was kicked out of in Western culture. Well, in late 19th century Germany, we see both of those things at work, and you see them at work in very particular ways. Part of what Peter Lavenda does very well in the early stages of his book is he starts not with Hitler, but he starts in the mid to late 19th century with this concept of Ultima Thule, this fragment that we've just read. And he gets into some of the early occultists who started to revive this myth, and particularly revive it as a prototype for what the German people could look like in the history. And they had talk about a coming Messiah, a pagan Messiah who would help to restore the Aryan race. Okay, now we're starting to take a few steps away just from the mythology to where we eventually wound up. Where we should go next, and I apologize if this feels a little bit scattershot. It is very difficult to try and trace all of this because, you know, I appreciate Peter Lavenda's book. He's a little bit disorganized in his thought. And I think that other people, you know, but that just isn't really the single scholar, organized scholarship that really does this. I'm trying to pull up here. Give me just a second.
I feel like I've heard that word Thule somewhere else. And I searched in comic books. No, not there. Is it in Ghostbusters?
You're thinking of Zool.
Yeah. No.
Very, very different.
Whoa. Where
no, Zool is Ghostbusters.
Yeah, you're right there. So where has Thule been used in media?
I have no idea.
I mean, doesn't that name sound familiar?
Yes, it does.
Okay.
Okay.
Did I kill enough time for you?
Yes, you did. Good. So the Thule Society, I needed to pull up their Wikipedia page here. The Thule Society, which as the name sounds, is a society that was founded in Germany shortly after World War I that was centered around trying to locate Ultima Thule, this ancient homeland of the Aryans. And among the people who were a part of this, there was some baron or other. Yes, here we go. Rudolf von Sebottendorf, who was the head of this society, and his symbol that he elected for himself was a dagger overlaid on top of a swastika.
Okay.
So how do we get to a swastika from this? This is just a little bit of an aside. But the Aryan, like if you trace Aryanism, not just as a Nazi phenomenon, but just as a ethnic phenomenon, you wind up with the Aryan language group, which grows out of Iran and some of that side of the world and dovetails into Sanskrit. And so you do get like this weird overlap of areas of the world that you would not think of as being Aryan in the ultimate Thule myth, but the swastika gets imported essentially through that. I'm probably oversimplifying, but it winds up being a symbol of this culture that it, or this cult, essentially this group of occultists that is trying to find Ultima Thule. And so they form this in the waning days of World War I, and the Thule Society has this blood declaration of faith. And the blood declaration of faith goes like this. The signer hereby swears to the best of his knowledge and belief that no Jewish or colored blood flows in either his or his wife's veins, and that among their ancestors are no members of the colored race. So we're starting to get there we're now many, many steps closer. So the Thule Society winds up being an influence on a number of people, including one, Adolf Hitler. Now, Hitler's own relationship to all of this is murky and it's confusing. It's one of the more confusing parts of Lavenda's books because Hitler will at various times seem like he is more directly influenced with this. And then at other times he does outlaw different occultic things, including astrologers. But Hitler's followers, some of his closest confidants, figures like Rudolf Hess, are very much part and influenced by the Thule Society, so much so that they form a organization within Nazi Germany that is a successor of the Thule Society called Honorebi, which is essentially let's talk about it a little bit. I'll come back to it in just a second, but it's a occultic organization meant to prove out Hitler's racial theories, especially around the Aryans. Essentially, they were promoting the Aryan in the sense of the Thule myth within Nazi Germany. And to the extent that you get some of these Indiana Jones-like stuff, it's from this wing of the Nazi Party. Interestingly enough, one of the most bizarre things that happens in World War II is the flight of Rudolf Hess. I don't know if you're familiar with this.
I don't know who that guy is.
So Rudolf Hess is a member of, you know, he's a big time Nazi. You know, you think of like Goering and Himmler and that level of Nazi. So okay. He's high up in the Nazi party. So he's with Hitler from the very beginning, you know, early 30s as the Nazi Party is coming to power. And then he does a extraordinarily bizarre thing in 1941. He gets in a plane and he has a solo flight to Scotland to try and negotiate peace with the United States. This is a matter of historical record.
Wow.
Rudolf Hess gets in a plane and flies to Scotland. Now, why and what in the world was going on, and how much was he speaking for himself, and how much was he going on behalf of Nazis, and how sincere was this, and all of that? All those are things of speculation. But one of the more interesting things that Levender speculates on in his book is that Hess was a big-time astrologist. He was very into astrology, and that there's reason to believe that Hess, based off of his horoscope, thought that this was what he needed to do. And it was shortly after Hess's doomed flight to Scotland, where he remained a prisoner of war for, you know, it didn't work out well for him. Hitler outlawed astrology. And so you have this weird dynamic, and the book gets into different things of like how you can interpret that and not. So Hitler's own relationship to a lot of this gets a little bit vague, but you wind up with this society, this wing within him. And the interesting thing within this group of this name I can't pronounce, I'll try it again, Honorabis, within Nazi Germany, is that they're there to promote the science of the Aryan racial beliefs. Now, if we look at Nazi Germany from a purely modernist scientific lens, we say, well, racial science, okay, fine. Like, they're trying to use the methods of the Enlightenment to prove the Nazi belief in Aryanism. And Aryanism meaning not in a mythic sense, but in the sense of the superiority of the German race. And it's like, okay, we can all look at that and say that's evil and that's bad and it did all sorts of horrible things, but we're not in the level of the occult. But that's not what this Honorabis society actually did. They were promoting the Aryan racial science in the sense of the occultic origins of it. So what we see as we start to bring in these occultic elements of the Aryan myth into Nazi Germany that came up through various occultists to the Thule Society and then were given license to exist and thrive within this Honorabis society within Nazi Germany right under Hitler's own nose, is that we find that Hitler's racial beliefs were much more than just I don't like Jewish people. They were much more than just on-the-nose racism. And I'm not excusing or trying to downplay, you know, racism as a sin. But they were ultimately the amalgamation of both bad science, modernism run amok through things like eugenics and racial science and social Darwinism and all of that, you know, all that stuff that we've heard of before, as well as this weird occult thing. And what we'll find then, when we start to unpack this a little bit more, and this is where we're going to turn to Kingsnorth to help us understand, okay, well, that's interesting, but so what? We're not Nazis. It's all done. I know everybody likes to throw around the term Nazi, but it's all done. This weird anomaly of the, even if we buy all of this, of the occult and science, was a one-time thing in the past. Well, not so, according to Peter Kingsnorth. Let me read a couple of things from him. He says, here is Francis Bacon's definition of science. This is the quote. The knowledge of causes and secret motions of things and the enlarging of human empire to the effecting of all things possible. And here is the occultist, Aleister Crowley's definition of magic. The science and art of causing change to occur in conformity with the will. These could be swapped around without anybody really noticing. The thread that links them is control. Both the scientific enterprise and the magical quest of which it was part spring from the same desire, to know the world and to bend it to our will. Will in both senses is the key, in both cases is the key word. When Aleister Crowley, pioneering occultist, rampant self-publicist, and self-described great Beast, created his own occult religion, Thelema, in the early 20th century. Yeah, this is what I was talking about earlier. He gave it its own famous commandment. Do what thou wilt shall be the whole of the law. Thelema wilted on the vine, but we could say that Crowley's dictum lived on as the foundational basis of what our culture has become. At this point, any scientist reading will be protesting, no, no, they might cry. That's not what we mean we do at all. We're driven only by curiosity, by wonder, by a desire to understand the world. Maybe, but science always and everywhere is handmade to technology, and technology is in this time neither neutral nor innocent. Einstein bombed Hiroshima just as surely as the pilots of the Enola Gay, and he knew it. My point is not that all magical workings or all scientific experiments are bad, let alone the people who carry them out. A magician might want to perform a working aimed at bringing good luck to a friend. A scientist may be searching for a cure for cancer. But the wider project of both carries hidden within it a telos, a direction of travel. It is the direction of the machine that now envelops us and the new world it is building. So the argument, to go, and I'll read the short quote I did earlier one more time, we see daily the path that magic and science will take us down. Do what thou wilt is the motto of our world, the motto of the machine. Thy will be done is its older brother and its challenger. So we have, according to Kingsnorth, a world where the aims of the occult and the aims of science are very much one and the same. They are aligned with each other. Okay. So still, it's like, okay, I can kind of see that connection there, but I don't know what, you know, that necessarily has any relevance. I can see how that happened in Nazi Germany, but that's not still happening today. All right, everyone, strap on your tinfoil hats, because now we're going to talk about AI. We're going to talk about.
Wow.
That's right. That's right. You did not see that coming.
I did not.
We're going to talk about not AI in the sense of, you know, your ChatGPT bot or the little module on your, you know, the Google Gemini search summary or anything like that. I want to talk about AI in the sense of consciousness and in the sense especially of the attempts to bring about ASI, artificial superintelligence. Now, I've dabbled over the years of our conversation with exploring some of the creepy things that can happen in AI, specifically with some of the illusions and some of the hallucinations and some of the weird conversations people have reported with chatbots. Rod Dreher actually has an interesting take on this, and his take is that most of the time, AI is just that, a chatbot, it's innocuous, whatever, you move on with your life. I also want to say for people who are like, oh, I'm scared to go into work and boot up my computer. That's not the intent of this. We're talking about things at a much bigger scale than whatever your boss wants you to do at work. But Rod Dreher also argues that at times, technology and AI can be a medium for non-human entities, demons included, to communicate to us. Is that so crazy? Don't most of us, as traditional Christians who have a respect for the occult, and by respect I mean a respect that it's not nonsense, we avoid it not because it's nonsense, we avoid it because it's real and it's evil, think that things like Ouija boards are evil? If you have a Ouija board in your house, you should throw it out. You should burn it. You should destroy it. It's evil. It's evil. Most of the time, a Ouija board's probably just a fun little party game. But I believe, and I'm guessing most of our listeners believe, it can be a tool to communicate with demons. So is that same possibility there with us in technology? Let's turn back to Kingsnorth. He says, we'll start here. When journalist Ezra Klein, for instance, asked a number of AI developers why they did their work, they told him straight. This is a quote. I often ask them the same question. If you think calamity is so possible, why do this at all? Different people have different things to say, but after a few pushes, I find they often answer from something that sounds like the AI's perspective. Many, not all, but enough that I feel comfortable in characterization, feel that they have a responsibility to usher this new form of intelligence into the world. back to King's North. Usher is an interesting choice of verb. The dictionary definition is to show or guide someone somewhere. Which someone exactly is being ushered in? This new form of intelligence? What new form? And where is it coming from? Some people think that they know the answer. Transhumanist Martin Rothblatt's new religion, Terrasem, says that by building AI systems, quote, we are making God, unquote. Fellow transhumanist Elise Bohan says, quote, we are building God, unquote. Kevin Kelly believes that, quote, we can see more of God in a cell phone than in a tree frog, unquote. Does God exist? Asks Google maven Ray Kurzweil. I would say not yet. Unquote. These people are doing more than trying to steal fire from the gods. They are trying to steal the gods themselves or to build their own versions. So when it comes to AI, you know, we're starting to have this nuanced take on AI, and that's being driven by a lot of things that I covered in the last episode. And I'm going to continue down that path. But I think there's a huge difference between is it safe to ask Copilot to help me format my Excel spreadsheet. I mean, maybe a helpful demon shows up and gives you a hand with that tricky formula. Okay? There's a world of difference between that and saying, let's create a new intelligence, a new consciousness. Let's create a super intelligence, and maybe one that can help rule over us, according to some people. I'd also chime in here and say that I, while less skeptical than some, am skeptical about the possibility of superintelligence actually occurring. I know some, like our friend Brian, believe it's extraordinarily far away and not of concern. I think I would rate myself many degrees more worried than Brian, but still sharing some of that skepticism. But in the same way that Thelma, or whatever I said.
Thule,
thank you, not Thelma. Thule didn't actually exist, but the madness of searching for it helped to drive the Nazi project. We can face the same thing down here. What we are seeing in the quest for artificial superintelligence, not by everyone, but by those voices that were just quoted by Kingsnorth, is the unsettling combination of the technological, the material, and the occult, and the evil, and the demonic. And what we're seeing then in our culture is, again, I'm not saying that that's going to wind up in the same place as Nazi Germany, but we're seeing, again, the desire to replace Christ at the head of our culture with this combination of magic and science. Do what thou wilt. So now let's go to some of the people who say, well, ASI is going to be a boon to humanity. And I've expressed my skepticism over that. And I've expressed my skepticism in the sense of, like, I don't think that a future where your every need is provided for you and you don't have to work is necessarily one that is conducive to human thriving. Let me say that even stronger now. A benevolent artificial superintelligence, well, certainly preferable to one that destroys us all in 10 minutes. Like, okay, I'll go with door B. Will be demonic, whether that's literally or figuratively, because that future where everything you want is provided to you, everything you need is provided to you, and you don't have to sweat or work or earn, is a demonic future. It's one that destroys humanity. It is one that causes humanity to turn its back on God's original commandment to fill the earth and multiply and subdue it, to work in God's image, to be God's image bearers in the world. And so what we see is the same thing coming around again. Do what thou wilt was the driving principle that forged science and the occult in Nazi Germany, and it's the same principle that is forging the quest for artificial superintelligence in our day. So am I going to be nuanced in AI? Absolutely. But I'm not nuanced in artificial superintelligence. That quest is evil, and it should be resisted. And whether or not it's possible, the search for it will have dire consequences on humanity.
Wow.
And for the record, I don't like those Nazi guys. Not a fan.
And you don't like AI.
Exactly.
So
at least not ASI.
Okay.
Again, like, it's too broad of a brush to say you just like or don't like AI.
Yeah, I hear what you're saying. Yeah, you're worried about artificial super intelligence or artificial general intelligence, but not about just AI tools.
I mean, I would say, again, even when it comes to AI tools, I just rejected a statement that I'm not a fan of it, and I'll also reject the statement that I'm not worried about it. I have a very nuanced view there. And again, if you listen to that AI episode, you know, the 30-second version of that is that, A, the definition is just shot. So trying to apply one opinion to everything that's labeled AI is worthless. And I would say the application is all over the map as well.
I Googled Thule because I'm wondering, where did I hear that? It looks like Lovecraft has used that word before.
Oh, that makes sense.
I bet I've heard it. And I haven't read much Lovecraft, but some. And then you and I haven't watched the show Supernatural, but listen to this. Supernatural features a society of necromancers called the Thules who can resurrect Hitler.
There you go.
And it says that that's drawing on real-world occultism, which we just covered here on The Sci-Fi Christian. So listeners, that's all from here. I'm Matt Anderson.
I'm Vandy Bono.
And we're The Sci-Fi Christian, signing off.
We'll be back with more Oops All Hitler Cookie Christmas next time.
Do you want to just quickly tease what's the next episode?
I mean, I don't know which it's going to be, so don't express a preference. Because
one or the other.
I have to dig into them and see what one catches my interest. But I'm very interested in Nazi Antarctic bases.
Okay, yep.
And I'm very interested in Nazi UFOs.
Okay. I won't tell you my preference, but we'll all be surprised
Maybe
in
they'll
January.
All come together. Okay. Maybe the Nazi UFOs are launching from the Antarctic bases.
That'd be great. All right, listeners. Thank you.
Goodbye.
And Merry Christmas, listeners. Merry this is our Christmas. Last episode. Last free... No, it's not, actually. We pre-recorded a free feed episode. Well, it was originally on the maybe uncensored feed, but next week, probably around New Year's, we'll air the final episode of what season are we in? Season 15? I think so, because next year will be our 16th year anniversary. So I think
we can drive.
Oh my goodness, 16 years!
That's pretty exciting.
Let's quickly check and confirm that. But yeah, I'm pretty sure
2011.
We started in 2011. Yeah, we're in season 15. Next, you know, in a couple of weeks, we start season 16 of The Sci-Fi Christian.
Amazing.
16 years? Well, technically our 15-year anniversary is in January 11th, everybody. So join us in celebrating. What should we do? Do you want to do something? It's kind of a milestone.
I don't know.
Get some food together. Yeah. Talk about things. All right, listeners, that's it. Goodbye.
Goodbye.